Here on FM, our book of the week is Stringer, the Indian journalist Anjan Sundaram's account of self-discovery. In 2005, aged just 22, Anjan gave up his maths PhD and spent a year and a half in war-torn Congo, where he found work with a news agency as a reporter or stringer. In today's episode, the struggle to find newsworthy stories continues, but an encounter with Bobby, an Indian businessman, leads to an opportunity to pursue the news along the Congo River. The reader is Riz Ahmed.
"I have a problem," Bobby said. "A piece of my land has been appropriated." He showed me a folder with his deed, covered in stamps and signatures of the authorities. Bobby's own signature was at the bottom, next to the title, Propriétaire. The plot was to the north of Kinshasa, in the jungle province of Equateur. It was large and must have cost a small fortune. Bobby claimed the appropriation was illegal. "The land has become a nature park. A US conservation group is now managing the territory, and the government has posted armed guards around it. Don't you think that is strange? I think there is something in that ground."
"Like what?" I asked.
"I don't know. Red mercury?" he said.
"I've never heard of it," I replied.
"It is a colloquial appellation. I am certain it is precious. I think they are mining something while calling it a conservation project."
"Is it expensive to reach your land?" I asked.
"The barges leave you right against the property. It is also cheaper and better to travel like the Congolese. We can move about with less hassle."
I decided to go. I wanted to go to the east, to the war. Bobby's proposal to travel upriver by barge excited me. We would go somewhere that few people ever traveled to. And the story we were chasing was fantastic. I started to prepare. Supplies needed to be purchased. Authorizations had to be obtained. I was traveling as Bobby's business partner.
"It is good we are both Indian. They ask less questions," he said.
We drove to the port to purchase tickets. The harbor bustled with people. Across the water, in the distance, were towers and wide buildings, the city of Brazzaville, in another Congo, and a quieter world. Our barge was being loaded. Its long platform was being piled with wooden boxes. Muddy water lapped against its sides. Rivets had rusted in their cavities. 2 days later, we left. Leaning beside Bobby at a railing at the stern of the barge, I felt an attachment to the city, and I began to fear our unknown passage. The water swiftly slipped beneath me, dark and yielding. Small waves rose and chuckled. The engine choked and came alive with a firm rumble. Kinshasa grew distant. The barge slowly shifted, like a mass of land separating from the earth. A sequence of wooden kiosks had been erected on the barge. Most were stuffed with supplies. The kiosks were near the center of the deck, where in a long pile running the barge's length, goods were covered in thick nets. Around this pile were groups of passengers tending to their affairs. The goods traveled to be exchanged for rural produce, palm oil, roots, meat, banana wine, and beer. Bobby and I were among the more privileged travelers. Our quarters lay in a wooden kiosk. Its splintered planks gave us a roof, but on the sides it was open to the world, and at night, the dark. Under this, Bobby had set up our tent. The houses on shore had thinned, giving way to green and brown bamboo and patches of red earth. Along the water, villagers soaped their bodies and scrubbed clothes. The trees moved by slowly. From ahead of the barge, pirogues set off with heavy loads and strong-armed rowers. The long black canoes were carried downriver and alongside our vessel, and the men frantically rowed, now coming at us from all sides, from the far horizon of the river and along its length, shooting out of the jungle like arrows. The barge was soon surrounded. All at once, the rowers flung thick black ropes like snakes from their pirogues.
A bell was rung fiercely near the captain's quarters, and the crew members poured out of their rooms. Ropes flew through the air in high arcs and lashed at the barge, wriggling on the deck, slipping away, falling into the water. They were flung again with more fury. The crewmen thrust forward, pulling the ropes with Venus arms. The pirogues fought the flow of the river, approaching and falling away, threatening to capsize in the swirling currents. The men heaved their oars and restored balance, rowing faster and more desperately until they moved within our wake where the river was calmer. The crew tied the ropes to posts, and the pirogues flowed steadily, without effort. And by evening, we tugged a collection of crafts like balloons, wanting to drift away on the river. At once the pirogues unloaded, and there was even less space. They were commercial vessels from the villages, and I realized that the scene I had witnessed was the attaching of the city with the jungle. Men walked to and from the pirogues, over the ropes, carrying bottles, nets, and livestock. They became for us a source of fresh food, and they relieved the traders of their city stocks. Most pirogues concluded their commerce and left by afternoon. I saw them detach from the barge and drift downriver toward their settlements. In the evening, the traders, having few customers left, relaxed by their stalls to reggae and rumba. The night ambiance on the barge was of charcoal stove fires and radio sets. The barge advanced northward, making a breeze against the rolling humidity, and soon even villages were rare. I was startled at how quickly we had left all signs of human development. Passing us was a constant level of jungle, without variation in the kind of tree, buttressed, stout, covered in woody creepers. The sound of the barge was a steady drone. All this created a distinct tension. The news agency informed me that I was missing a number of stories in Kinshasa. The editors called to ask where I was, though they had known about my expedition. The line was crackly. They were annoyed. To pass the time, Bobby suggested we play checkers, but after playing for several days, we had an altercation and an impasse formed between us. The tension on the barge grew. I felt stressed, on edge. And this stress was irreconcilable with the heat, which wanted to draw one into a stupor. Looking out on the river, often alert, as if searching for something, I one day became conscious of the disappearance of the beaches. The river was walled by jungle, and watching this green continuum, I felt lonely. One of Mobutu's palaces appeared on the riverbank, set on a mud cliff. It was a decrepit colonial-style construction with pillars, a triangular roof, whitewash, paved verandas. The dictator's palaces were legendary. José had told me that they were walled with jade, that the doorknobs were jeweled. Though Mobutu had died nearly a decade earlier, one still felt his influence everywhere, particularly here in the jungle, an ancient part of Congo and of the world. People here were remote. Disconnected. Mobutu didn't build roads, ostensibly to protect himself from coups, but it had the effect of isolating the people and restricting their development. The palace drifted past. It had begun to be buried by the jungle. The captain announced we would stay the night in Irebu. Most passengers found places in villagers' homes. Bobby negotiated a mattress for us in a storeroom. But when we lay down to sleep, I saw the ceiling was covered in bats all the way to the eaves, so I convinced Bobby to move to the courtyard. Again, we were in the tent. Outside, familiar night insects clicked and chirped, each playing its part in the forest cacophony. The following day, the news came. A routine inspection by the crew found a malfunction with the engine cooling system, and we would have to take apart the engine. The engineers said they could fix it in a day, that the problem was not serious. They worked for 2 days, then four. The captain eventually told us we would have to wait for a barge to bring us spare parts. Our journey had run aground. A small festival started on the barge. People swarmed the deck, dancing to music from the large speakers. Villagers joined. The scene and the music seemed foreboding.
our predicament would not be resolved soon. One day a fisherman's boy told me he had found a dead beast. He wanted to show me. It was just outside the village, he said, near the fields. We passed old dwellings without tops, shielded by tall grass, and we entered a clearing in the jungle where, covered with creepers and leaves, was the frame of an aircraft. The fuselage gaped open, half sunk into the floor. The boy thought it could be worth a lot for its strangeness, that he could sell it at the port. I looked up, but the forest was impenetrable, and I couldn't make out the path by which the plane had come. We left the carcass as we had found it. On the walk back, I learned the boy, whose name was Bahati, was a refugee from Rwanda. His family had been killed by the Rwandan army, and a villager had adopted him. He said we could perhaps go cycling together if I was interested. Two pygmy settlements were located not far away. So the next day, we borrowed two bicycles and set out. It was raining, so the ride was difficult. We reached the village in half a day. A pygmy chief with a brown civet cat skin over his shoulder came to greet us. The chief said his ancestors had once worked on a colonial plantation. When the plantation closed, the workers had nowhere to go, and they had become used to the settled life. But they were now destitute, like an urban slum set in the jungle. Some men emerged from their houses in ornamental headgear, thinking I was an important visitor from the logging companies. The pygmies had lately been rediscovered by the companies. New Congolese forest laws, meant to conserve the ecology in their habitats, had given these tribes authority over traditional lands. The pygmy chief had sold his rights to the loggers. He had given away a vast swathe of land, and all he had asked from the loggers was some soap and bags of salt. It was painful to hear of his naive trade. I asked the chief why he needed salt. He said his ancestors had once known how to extract the mineral from plants, but his people, from years of plantation work, had forgotten how. And the chief was certain the loggers could never wipe out the forest. "Just look," he said. "It goes on forever." I wrote a story for the agency about this extortionate logging. It was a story written with some passion, for the pygmy chief showed me something about the world and its crisis. I had come to Congo with natural sympathy for humans living in the forests, stemming from a belief that these people practiced traditions that were thousands of years old, and that they had over the ages learned to exist in equilibrium with the animals. But the pygmy chief showed me that globalization had reached even these villages in the form of sneakers, guns and cigarettes, and most violently as demand for raw materials, food, wood, meat. Severed from the forest, the world consumed it rapaciously. The pygmies were being encroached upon by this global need. These tribes lived in the forest, but they were no longer purely of the forest. They would not survive the change. This story about the forest, which in my excitement I called my editor at once to relay, struck a chord in him. The story made the rounds within the agency, and months later, it won a prize. My editor told me something personal for the first time since we had begun to work together. He too had begun his career in Congo. He had also struck out on his own to find his first stories. In this way, we formed a small bond. I got the sense that he wanted to help me. It was the first success of the journey.
Riz Ahmed read Stringer by Anjum Sundaram. The abridger was Richard Hamilton. The producer is Elizabeth Allard. Coming up after the news, Woman's Hour.
What we want to create is an atmosphere whereby people can really talk honestly and openly about their experiences.
I didn't have that moment when I thought enough was enough.
We've talked to people who have survived a near-death experience. We've also talked to people who've fallen off the wagon.
Well, maybe I'll try Cinzano. Or maybe I'll try Blue Nun.
Good Lord.
I know, exactly. That was desperate measures.
Say something.
Fee Glover presents a new series of Shared Experience on BBC Radio 4, beginning next Tuesday afternoon at 3:30.